With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese and Ryan Marine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365's sports car racing podcast in Indianapolis. I'm Ryan Marine. We've got John DeGeese in Chicago as well, coming off of a massively busy weekend of sports car racing. SRO America, we had ELMS, we had SRO Europe, we had Super GT, we had Lamborghini Super Trofeo. What wasn't in action? I guess we had IMSA and WEC on the sidelines, but it seemed like everything else was running.
Yeah, it was an incredible weekend. All I could say is just check out Sports Car 365 for the majority of those race reports. I think we're going to just be focusing more on the SRO America stuff in our recap here this week. But for ELMS, Lamborghini Super Trofeo, GT World Challenge Europe, and GT4 European Series, the list goes on. Just check out the website.
It's a packed website right now, that's for sure. Plenty of coverage from over the weekend, and let's be honest, it's just great to have sports car racing content back in full force once again after so many months of absolutely nothing. This has kind of been a fun period of time from that perspective. So we've got a lot to recap, as you said. We've got news to get to on the show because plenty of that came out in the last week as well. And we'll wrap things up with a question from a listener as well as a look ahead at what's to come this coming weekend. But starting with SRO America at Sonoma and with the GT World Challenge America powered by AWS specifically, which for the second straight event was teamed with GT Sports Club America, the result still was not the car count that we were hoping for. We had a couple more casualties coming into the weekend, and we have reason to believe at least one of those GT3 cars will be back later on in the season, that being the second Acura from Racer's Edge Motorsports. Nevertheless, just not quite what we would have hoped for, without a doubt, even with the COVID situation in mind. Still, though, we did have a little bit of drama there with Racer's Edge. They have the lone Silver Cup entry in the championship, that being Shelby Blackstock and Trent Hedman. And, John, we've seen them exhibit just tremendous pace throughout the season, and it's come down to them beating themselves as far as the overall win is concerned when they have not won overall. And in race one on Saturday, we saw that happen again.
Yeah, it was unfortunately a rules technicality that came out prior to the start of the weekend. I think on Thursday, a bulletin was issued that altered the pit stop window for GT World Challenge America competitors. It delayed it by 5 minutes because of the conclusion of the GT Sports Club race. That race is a 40-minute race inside the 90-minute GT World Challenge race. And ultimately, what seemed to have happened at VIR was that there was a bit of a congestion in pit lane as those sports club cars were finishing up their race, perhaps on a cool down lap, and getting in the way of cars, you know, GT3 cars making hot pit stops. So the officials decided to delay the pit window by 5 minutes. And ultimately, it looked like Racer's Edge didn't get that memo and unfortunately pitted right as the window would have opened under a normal race weekend, or it would have opened under at COTA or VIR, and ultimately they had to make a second stop later in the race to serve that, to fulfill that full service pit stop, and lost the race because of it. And we saw Squadra Corsa pick up the overall win with Martin Fuentes and Rodrigo Baptista. It was the 300th win for Ferrari with its 488 GT3 car in global competition. So really impressive stuff there. But yeah, it was an odd one from Racer's Edge, especially as, you know, I would have thought they would have been up on reading all of the bulletins and everything. But, you know, there are some strange things that go on over the course of a weekend, and things could always slip through really quickly. And unfortunately, that was one for the Trent Hedman and Shelby Blackstock driven car there.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I talked to John Meraki, who owns that team, and simply put, where that bulletin came through, it's not necessarily the easiest thing to find, and they simply missed it. And so I know that they had some communication with the series stressing that with something this important, please don't just leave it to a bulletin. Make sure that your teams are aware of this. But I'd say on the flip side, the other teams seem to know, and so I think John was there. He readily raised his hand and accepted some blame. But on the flip side, I think the series can do more to better communicate with its teams. And I think that's what we'll see moving forward there. And the good news for them is, like I said, they're the only Silver Cup entry. So they still win in their class. They still score those points. They're here really to win overall because they don't have anyone in class to race against. So I know they were very disappointed, but at least with the championship in mind, should another Silver Cup car materialize at some point, they're still in very good shape from that standpoint. And they turned around very quickly and absolutely dominated race two, which I think we've come to expect at this point. Frankly, I was expecting a bit more from that Squadra Corsa lineup than what we've seen so far. I thought the combination of Fuentes and Baptista would be able to consistently take the fight to Blackstock and Hidman, but that really hasn't materialized to this point. And as we saw on Sunday with race two, Racer's Edge and that car specifically has been the class of the field all throughout the season.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point there, Ryan, with Fuentes and Baptista. They had a bit of bad luck over the weekend with, I think there was a tire issue in qualifying and then suspension or a shock absorber that went late in the stages of race two. But yeah, in terms of raw speed, they should have been a little closer, I would have thought. But then again, it is Rodrigo's first time in a Ferrari. He has been mainly in a Bentley GT3 car up until now. And if he's jumping back and forth between right-hand drive and left-hand drive, that could be a big change, you know, especially racing in Europe now with the Bentley and coming back here in the Ferrari. They're totally different cars. So not trying to make excuses, but I think that, you know, maybe as the season goes on, as he gets more used to jumping back and forth, maybe it'll be a little stronger of a threat, or maybe it's down to the BOP a little bit. I don't know, because we don't have an Acura as a reference car in Europe, so the global BOP could be a little bit lopsided in America. You don't know. So interesting observations nonetheless, and hopefully we can get a little bit closer racing, you know, in a head-to-head battle as the season unfolds.
Looking ahead to the next round at Road America, track that kind of welcomes some of that a bit more than Sonoma, which, speaking to the drivers throughout the GT3 class, they say, hey, this is a super fun track to drive, not necessarily the best as far as racing goes and trying to make passes and things of that nature, and that was on display, unfortunately, over the weekend. So congratulations, nevertheless, to all of the winners from the GT3 side of things. We can move now to some GT4 conversation. The series that the two of us have been talking up over the past couple, well, I guess year and a half at this point, Pirelli GT4 America Sprint, which I felt like has put on some of the best shows in all of sports car racing here in that time period, not really the case over the weekend. It was all Michael Cooper, pretty much from the word go. He had to make a bold move on Spencer Pompelli in the first of the three races over the weekend. Who Spencer started on pole, Michael to the outside, and he was able to grab the lead right there at the start. And, you know, his comment to me post-race in one of the Victory Lane interviews was that move really dictated the rest of the weekend because it allowed him to run up front, put in fast time early, lock in pole position for the next two races, and he was able to control the field from there.
Yeah, just looking at outside of that opening lap fight there in race one, the rest of the weekend was Michael Cooper domination, and it was almost that we had three different classes in GT4 Sprint, mm-hmm. Pro, Am, and Cooper, because he was in a class of his own, and the margins of victories were a bit smaller, but I think he was really just controlling and cruising at some point. And he wasn't shy to really admit that, hey, this is a track he really likes. This is a track he's been good at. He's won in GT3 competition up against the likes of Johnny O'Connell, Alvaro Parent, other guys back in the heyday of Pirelli World Challenge GT racing when the factory Cadillac program was in existence. And I think that, you know, it says a lot for, you know, how well he did. And yeah, there is limited competition in Sprint right now. We still do have some other pro cars with, like you said, Spencer Pompelli, and Jared Andretti's really come of age this year and in a pro, and Drew Staveley stepping up as well. But I don't think there's anybody that really can match Cooper lap for lap. And that's no disrespect to Spencer and the TRG team. I think they're the closest, but it's still, you know, the combination of a McLaren factory driver, black dog speed shop. I think, you know, even taking Sonoma out of the equation, and we've seen this. This was, I think, his fifth straight win. Or
that's right, five in a row.
Yeah, he's won all but two races this year, I think. So he's just moving into a league of his own. And it's no disrespect to the competition, but I think it's really showing how strong this package really is.
Now, speaking of coming of age, Michael Dinan, who is driving for Flying Lizard in an Aston Martin, he was really strong, as he has been all season in the AM category. He's really come a long way, and that was on full display, although it was a mix of different drivers winning races. I think he's been the outstanding driver in GT4 Sprint AM throughout the course of the season under the tutelage of Robbie Foley, and the two of them actually teamed for an overall win in GT4 Sprint X over the weekend. It was a mixed-up GT4 Sprint X weekend. There wasn't much consistency from race to race. We had different overall winners. Nola Sport, Flying Lizard, Marco Polo Motorsports as well, with Nikolai Elganian and Mads Siljehaug, which actually, I think, was the entry that was most intriguing. They certainly had the best pace, but did not have the best luck, unfortunately, with turbo issues in races 1 and 3, but they were, when they were able to put a full race together, they won in race 2 and were pretty dominant in doing so.
Yeah, it was interesting to see the different dynamics in Sprint X, and I have to say those races were a little bit more enjoyable to watch over the weekend. Like you said, a very good variety of winners, and I was really impressed with the Flying Lizard team of Robbie Foley and Michael Dinan getting the victory in race 3. That was Dinan's first overall win in GT4 America competition, and yeah, unfortunately, later on that day, Michael didn't have as good of luck in the sprint race. He had a bit of an issue with Paul Terry and got together with and got a penalty, and then late in the stage of that race had another coming together with him, but yeah, that was for AM class honors in the sprint race. But like you said, Sprint X delivered, I think, a little more exciting racing, but I think that had to be because of the car count as well. They had more than double the amount of cars, I think 25 in total compared to the 11 in sprint. And I think it just put on a little bit better of a show. You had the driver change pit stop. It made for a little bit more exciting action. Some teams having some slow stops, shaking up the order. You know, sometimes you don't see that in every single race, and sometimes they're a little more straightforward, but Sonoma brought out a little more exciting action in Sprint X.
Part of that, too, is tire degradation is such a huge part of the conversation at Sonoma, and you're having two drivers sharing the car and sharing the same set of tires over the course of that race. And I think the Saturday race in particular is one every weekend that's really interesting because you start with the pros, you hand off to the AMs, and there's a lot of cases of really fast pros turning over to AMs that don't have that kind of pace, especially when you have some silver cars buried a little bit deeper in the field where the second driver is going to be quite strong. You have a lot of comers and goers, and that does make for some captivating racing. I think we've seen that throughout the course of the season.
Yeah, and one car to take note of for that actually was the one of the Reardon Mercedes with Chris Wilson and John Allen, and that was an AM car, and it was really impressive to see how far up Chris Wilson can get when he started the race or even finished the race to some respect. Unfortunately, you know, John's still learning. He's still coming to grips with the car, and he has a great tutor with Chris as his co-driver. But you really do see the dynamics there, even in an AM-AM pairing.
It's one of those where the driver ratings kind of creates for a bizarre situation where Chris Wilson is counting as an AM.
Yeah.
He is a very, very good race car driver. He just happens to be a little bit older, and therefore he gets derogated down to a bronze, and he can run as an AM, which lets them do some interesting things with strategy. But in all reality, he's got the pace and experience of a lot of the pros, so it is kind of a strange one there. And to John Allen's credit, this was the same pairing they had last year, but John could not maintain when he got in the car more often than not last year, and that has changed. He's really found a little bit of extra speed, found some more confidence, and they've had some good results here the last couple of rounds as a consequence. The final thing I'd like to bring up regarding the weekend is it was the second weekend with all the COVID protocols in place for SRO America, VIR being the first, and I will say the second time around, it seemed like it was normal now. Everyone was used to it. You didn't really see people having to be reminded to keep their masks on. People just were naturally keeping distance. It seemed to go a lot more smoothly. Plus, the event check app that's been introduced that is being utilized to help monitor where people are and make sure that people fill out the correct forms and things of that nature, that has come online now in full, which also helped quite a bit. But it is interesting to me, John, just how quickly the paddock has adapted to this situation, and where at VIR it felt like everything was new and different and strange, it didn't feel that way at all anymore. It happened really quickly, it seemed. And I know you've been at an IMSA paddock, or at least around an IMSA paddock at Road America, so that was a little bit into IMSA's adoption of their own protocols. Did you kind of notice the same thing, that by that point it was business as usual for the people who've been on site now for several events?
Yeah, it seems that's the case all around. And I think everybody's sort of come, you know, whether you like it or not, you know that you have to adhere to these protocols in order to keep racing. And it's pretty simple. So everybody's embracing it. The unfortunate thing is you don't have those kind of conversations with, you know, the fellow teams or drivers or the whole friendly paddock atmosphere that an SRO America event brings, for instance. You know, you can't really enjoy that as much as you did before. You know, I'm sure under the, you know, there used to be some great hospitality tents and food, and they have some nice conversations. And I'm sure you have more experience in this than I do, Ryan, right now through this, but it's just the case of COVID sort of restricting that. But at the same time, I think we all understand we all have jobs to do and things to get done in order to have the great racing on track and be able to continue racing as one of the very few sports that really has been rather uninterrupted right now. You know, sure, we had this big long pause, you know, like everybody in the sporting world. But when you look at all these other sports that are trying to get back into action and all these cases, you know, positive cases of COVID popping up in MLB and other sports, and then racing still keeping themselves relatively safe. You know, there really hasn't been any kind of outbreaks of any stretch in motorsports anywhere around the world. That sort of shows how seriously everybody is taking this, and I think everybody should be commended for doing this such of a good job as they are.
Yeah, it's a good point. There have been isolated cases, but to this point, nothing of any real magnitude in terms of numbers, so we can be thankful for that. It keeps the entertainment going, and for those of us who work in the sport, it keeps our jobs going, and we're certainly thankful for that. Let's step away from Sonoma and briefly run through some of the other racing that went on over the weekend, because, man, there was a lot of it. SRO Europe was in action. It was a sprint round, three races over the course of the weekend. It would have been Dries Van Thor and Charles Wertz who won two of the three. That was for Belgian Audi Club Team WRT. The third race was won by Raffaele Marchiello and Timur Boguslavski. That was for AKA ASP and a Mercedes. You can find our coverage of that race at those races, at sportscar365.com. Same for the ELMS race over the weekend. That was at Spa. LMP2 saw United Autosport, Philippe Albuquerque, and Phil Hansen picking up the win. Some late race drama there, as I understand it. G-Drive having some problems late, which put United in the pilot seat. It was a United win in LMP3 as well. Wayne Boyd, Tom Gamble, and Rob Weldon winning from pole in that class. GTE went to Kessel Racing, leading home a Ferrari 1-2 in the LMS. Again, full coverage at sportscar365.com. You can find coverage from Lamborghini Super Trofeo North America. They were racing at Road America as part of the NASCAR weekend. Super GT was racing at Fuji. There was a whole lot of other stuff, too, and that'll be in the weekly racing roundup, so just keep your eyes peeled on the website. To the news of the week now, John, and no bigger news than the news out of Le Mans, with the announcement that despite all the efforts that were put into finding a clever workaround to allow fans to attend the 24 hours of Le Mans, it simply was not going to be feasible, and the announcement has come out. No fans for Le Mans this year.
Yeah, part of me is surprised, but part of me really isn't. This is, you know, I think a week after it was announced that the Indianapolis 500 will not have any fans. And I know Indy and Le Mans are very different events in terms of, you know, how spectators soak in the event. But I think it's just sort of a sign of the times right now where these major, huge spectator events just can't operate even with just a handful of fans. You know, I think Le Mans was looking to have around 50,000 split up into 10 different quote villages. They were limited to 5,000 people per village, and it would basically restrict these fans at certain parts of the track to certain parts of the track. And ultimately, it was decided with the South region and the ACO not to have those materialize at all. France is going through a little bit of a spike right now in COVID cases. Europe as a whole is, I think, a bit, and I think they're trying to err on the side of caution. I think it's a wise move, especially, you know, you don't want Le Mans to take center stage for the wrong reasons in case there is issues. And I think that's the same thing that happened with the Indy 500. So it's disappointing. I'm sure there was a lot of fans that were looking forward to this race, even though it would have came with a lot of compromises. But I think it was the right call.
Yeah, I think you're right. And as soon as the news about Indy came out, I started wondering if this might be the direction that Le Mans would head as well. It's a real shame for so many reasons, but ultimately, if it preserves the race, it means the race can keep on for this year, and it avoids any kind of negative publicity for the event that could hurt the future of the event, then I think it's probably worthwhile to sacrifice here in the short term with the hope of everything returning to something resembling normal for the long term.
And we should also note that, you know, the Nürburgring 24 is going to be without fans as well. So that's another major spectator event. I think it's the biggest spectator event in Germany every year. So sporting event in Germany every year. So that's, you know, that was sort of a sign, I think, about a month ago or 3 weeks ago when they had announced that. That started getting the ball rolling, thinking, hey, I think Le Mans might be next. And sure enough, it is.
Okay, but that was not the extent of the changes due to COVID that have happened in the last week. I guess we're getting used to this at this point, so I can't help but chuckle a little bit because it seems like every week we're announcing some change or we're discussing some change that has occurred. Let's start staying in the ACO side of things with an ELMS schedule change, which will see Paul Ricard replace Barcelona on the European Le Mans Series calendar.
Yeah, so that'll be a second outing at Paul Ricard, same weekend as initially scheduled, but not going to Spain due to a rise in COVID cases there. I think Spain has actually been probably the worst country in terms of spikes in recent weeks, and Gerard Nouveau and his team at the LMEM took quick action to make this happen, and hats off to all involved for doing it. It's unfortunate that it's going to be a second race at Paul Ricard. I'm sure teams would like some variety in the championship, but it's an easy round to just plug and play. They know what to do. They don't have to go search for another track. And also, I think it's important to have a race in France in the build up to Le Mans, just in case there are quarantine laws and restrictions for crew members and teams. They could theoretically just stay in France, actually, if they really had to, through the Le Mans race if they needed to. I know the UK has imposed some restrictions now for quarantining and whatnot from Belgium into the UK. And then I think nothing from I'm not entirely sure about France. It changes by the day. But I know our Dan Lloyd is actually on top of all things because he's going to be traveling to Spa this weekend. And then hopefully getting out to the Nürburgring for the next GT World Challenge Europe Endurance Cup race and then the Le Mans, so, and the Nürburgring 24 after that. So there's a lot of travel there and a lot of logistical nightmares. But going back to the ELMS schedule change, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And hopefully this could be one of the final changes, but I'm afraid that we may still have some more, both, you know, in Europe and North America.
And one that we did learn about for North America, we've really seen the writing on the wall for this one for quite some time, the SRO America weekend at Watkins Glen. Pretty much anything that has been scheduled for Watkins Glen except for that event, and maybe there was a Ferrari Challenge event as well that had been on the calendar, had already been moved. So now those two events both got the axe as well. The interesting thing with that is that there was no replacement event announced because this was a track press release on the SRO America side, but we both have reason to believe that there will be a replacement, and it will probably be announced imminently. It seems to me that Circuit of the Americas and Barber are the two most likely replacements, and lately I've been hearing more about headed down to Austin than headed to Alabama, so we'll see where that heads. But yeah, not a big surprise here, was it, John?
No, not at all. And I think there's only one event that remains on Watkins Glen's schedule, and I think it's a historic race of some kind. They've actually, like you said, canceled the Ferrari Challenge weekend as well. It was issued in the press release on Monday. So real disappointment for the fans in the Northeast. This is all largely due to New York, Connecticut, other states up there having a pact where there are mandatory 14-day quarantines for the majority of people in others from other states. And IMSA and the NASCAR had gotten around that quarantine, that they had an exemption, but only if they were able to successfully test all of their participants at the track. And that would have turned out to be too much of a expense for those series, and I'm sure it would have been the same for SRO America. I'm not sure how far along they were into discussions for something like that, but it makes a lot more sense for SRO to look elsewhere. Like I said, personally, I would like to maybe see it at Barber to have some variety in the championship, but if it's settled at COTA, again, that's one of those tracks that they know very well as well, much like ELMS knowing Paul Ricard. SRO America's go-to track would probably be COTA for a number of reasons as well. So let's wait and see what's announced. Hopefully, maybe we can get some word later in the week from the series on that.
Moving away from the schedule news, how about some news about the future for some Porsche factory drivers that right now are employed in North America? We know that the factory GTLM program is done at the end of this year. We also know that Porsche has certainly been evaluating LMDH, but there's going to be a gap between the end of the GTLM program and the beginning of any LMDH program from Porsche. So where does this leave the drivers? I know you've talked to a few. What have you learned about what position they find themselves in?
Well, it's an interesting one because the majority of the Porsche drivers racing in IMSA, most notably Lawrence Vanthar, Earl Bamber, and Nick Tandy, they want to stay racing in America, and there aren't really many options from the Porsche perspective. It's already been ruled out of having a customer GTLM entry for next year. There are GTD entries, you know, Wright Motorsports fields a car. They were planning to do two. FAF is obviously another team that had planned to do a full season, but those are all rather limited, and they have existing pro drivers already sort of allocated. So the options for these guys are really relatively limited under Porsche. And we've learned that a number of them have made inquiries with DPI teams or teams that could be campaigning DPIs next year in the WeatherTech Championship. And that points to the speculation that Porsche could be helping them, you know, or sort of guiding them in that direction, saying, hey, it might be a good idea to get some prototype experience if we were to go LMDH racing in 2022, 2023, or maybe 2024. We don't know the actual date when LMDH will debut. That's the other big component of all of this right now. I spoke to John Doonan, IMSA's president at Road America last month about that, and he was firm that there has been no decision, despite my hearing that already has been delayed by a year internally, that IMSA teams have been informed that DPI will be through at least the end of the 2022 season. In Europe, there's rumors that LMDH may not come online until 2024. So, yeah, there's a lot in the mix here. And the other interesting aspect is Pascal Zurlinden, the Porsche Motorsport factory boss, has admitted that it would be a bit difficult for Porsche to be on the grid in 22 with an LMDH, given the timeline. So if Porsche is saying that it's tough to be on the grid in 2022, given the timeline, they're kind of the barometer for all of this in terms of having the experience of building a car and of going sports car racing in almost virtually every category out there. So if they're saying it's going to be tough, I think it's unlikely we'll be seeing LMDH in 22. And this could just make the situation even more complex for some of these factory drivers like Lawrence Vanthar and Earl Bamber and perhaps Nick Tandy, who might try to pursue a DPI drive, but it won't just be for 1 year. It could be for 2 years then. And then that puts the pressure on, well, would a team be willing to campaign those drivers under a potential on the different manufacturer, and what kind of support would there be? It opens up a whole can of worms. So interesting times for sure. And I think there's going to be a lot of drivers on the market looking into next year. And I think a lot of people are sort of just waiting to see where these manufacturers turn, what's next, and could we see potential maybe customer DPIs in 21 that could maybe morph into more of a factory program with another manufacturer in the years to come.
On the subject of delaying LMDH to 2023, kind of hearing what Porsche is saying, it seems to mesh with the inclination that at least would be the move to delay it by a year, because the powers that be have always been saying, we'll let the market decide on the timeline. And ultimately, the market are these manufacturers, right? And if Porsche is saying this, I can't imagine there's any other manufacturer that would be close to ready to roll something out in 2022.
Yeah, I think we've just had too much of a delay in this early part of the year due to COVID that sort of has ruled this out from happening. And it's going to be a hit for WEC and IMSA, because, you know, IMSA's getting by with the manufacturers they have. Okay, 7-8 cars, that's not too bad. But WEC's in a much worse situation, because you have LMP1 basically going away at the end of the year. Ginetta's come out and said they will not run any factory cars on their own. There could be a potential for some customers, but I think it's unlikely. That leaves the Le Mans hypercars, which, you know, you have presumably two Glickenhaus and two Toyota and possibly the Baikalis. And okay, that's five cars, but will both Glickenhaus be around for two full seasons? We don't know. You know, there's still a lot of questions of what the WEC will even look like next year with how many races. A lot of teams have expressed a reduction in the calendar is necessary for its survival. There's so much uncertainty right now over things, but you know, even after publishing this story, I had intel coming from some sources saying, well, are you sure about 2023? We're hearing it's 2024 for LMDH, which is crazy, because how are these, you know, two premier series going to be able to survive another three full seasons with, you know, existing DPI machinery in IMSA or the Le Mans hypercar, which is basically, you know, Toyota and Glickenhaus? Peugeot may be coming in 2023 or 2022. The latest rumors point to them leading towards a hypercar effort. So that might not be as bad over there then, but still just a lot of questions, I think.
Yeah, so what, DPI came online in 2017? So if you're pushing to 24, that's a 7-year life cycle for the cars.
Yeah, you know, the original DPs had a much longer life cycle, so you can argue that. And they had car counts there, but the problem you have here is, you know, we had a couple manufacturers that were on the brink of building DPIs with Ford and Lexus, and they both been sort of put on the shelf because they were new generation regs on the way, and they were supposed to debut mid-season in 21 in WEC. Then the calendar shuffle there happened, then everything got shuffled to 22, and now we're talking 23 or maybe 24. And within that time frame, those two manufacturers could have had a 3 or 4 year lifespan with a DPI, but now it's too late to go build one of those because it's going to take a year and a half to do that. So regulations and COVID have really, really affected things, I think, in terms of the manufacturer market.
Yeah, really fascinating. It's going to be very interesting to see how this develops. Just so many moving parts and pieces and not much certainty about anything at this point. A couple other topics to get to, team-related. How about an IMSA team that's going to be headed to Le Mans? WeatherTech Racing, run by Scuderia Corsa, initially on the entry list for Le Mans as a GTE AM car, but they've been upgraded, if you will, to GTE Pro, with Cooper McNeil set to be joined by Tony Wielander and Jeff Siegel. It seems to me, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but just a dearth of bronze rated drivers, right, to team with Cooper, that kind of precluded the AM, so if they wanted an entry, they were going to have to step up?
Essentially, yeah. They claimed they had two bronze-rated drivers that were possibly in the frame, but both drivers could have had travel restrictions depending on the evolving situation here. So ultimately, they wanted to make the proactive choice in making sure they could make the race and not have to make a last-minute change to GTE Pro with maybe a two-driver lineup or something like they did a couple years back when Brett Curtis had that crash and Cooper and Jerome Bleekemolen ended up driving the entire race in a two-driver lineup, which was a great story. It was a cool ending and everything.
And they did quite well.
Yeah, I think they finished seventh or something in GTE Pro. So, you know, I think there's only seven or eight GTE Pros this year to begin with. So the chance for them to do even better is stronger, you know. And having somebody like Jeff Siegel, a previous Le Mans class winner, along with Velander, a previous GTE Pro class winner at Le Mans, Siegel winning an AM in 2016 with Scuderia Corsa. I think this is going to be a really good lineup. And, you know, sure, Cooper doesn't have the pace of the factory cars or the factory drivers, but if you play it right, if you play the yellows right, the drive time requirements, I think, are less in GTE Pro than an AM. It could really work out. So I'm pretty intrigued to see how this package will perform. Scuderia Corsa does not have any GTE Pro experience at Le Mans, but they do have experience in that class in the States in the WeatherTech Championship. They ran a 488 GTE in the Endurance Cup races, I think, in 2016. So they do have some experience going up against all pro lineups. So it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds.
And then on the IMSA side of things, we got some good news that Paul Miller Racing will be returning to the championship after a brief hiatus.
Yeah, spoke to Mitchell Simmons, the team manager for Paul Miller Racing. He confirmed that they will be at VIR, and that's going to be used more as a to get back in the swing of things, shake off some rust as the team plans to do the remainder of the Michelin Endurance Cup races. And that rationale is really due to the fact that they're leading the Endurance Cup right now because of their victory at Daytona. And now, especially so that Watkins Glen has been replaced by a second race at Michelin Raceway Road Atlanta. This makes it kind of a no-brainer for the team, which is based right outside of the, based in the Atlanta area. So they're planning to do the 6 hours of Road Atlanta in Labor Day weekend, then go back to Road Atlanta for the Petit Motul Petit Le Mans, and then finish out the season in the 12 hours of Sebring in November. That's the plan right now. Mitchell stressed that there's nothing 100% confirmed. They're going to be taking it more race to race on the endurance races, but he doesn't see anything that would get in the way right now. But they're extremely mindful of the COVID situation, and if things do get worse and whatnot, they're going to have to reevaluate. But I think this is really good news for Lamborghini and great news for Brian Sellers and Madison Snow and Corey Lewis, too, for that matter, because he'll be the third driver in for those Enduros once the VIR race is over for the team.
More on those stories up at sportscar365.com, plus other news that we didn't have time to get to on the show this week can be found at the website. Let's wrap things up with a listener question. This one's from at @ATFlorio on Twitter, who wants to know, is the Mazda TCR project still alive? He says, I remember that the project was pushed out a year to 2021, but haven't heard anything more. Going with the VW engine, he says, led him to believe that they would be on track sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I haven't heard anything either. Mazda's been going through some shakeups in the PR department and communications, and it's been sort of hard to get answers from them, quite frankly, especially being limited, not having access to the paddock. We'll try to get an answer for you on this. Pre-COVID, I had heard everything was going to be on track for it to debut later this year, but I'm not sure where it stands right now, so hopefully we'll get an answer.
Yeah, sorry, I've got nothing to add to that either. I was hoping to talk to somebody who might have known at Sonoma over the weekend, but it didn't work out for various reasons, so sorry. We'll do our best to dig up something for you, and we'll get it to you on a future show. Let's wrap it up, though, John, here by looking ahead at the weekend to come. We've got the WEC returning to action at Spa. Big warm-up here ahead of the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
Yeah, this is, I think, the final major series you know, to be back in action after the long COVID break. And we have to remember that Sebring was canceled on such short notice for the WEC. All of the team's equipment was shipped back to Europe, and a lot of teams have tested since then, and now they're ready to get back in action. I'm looking forward to the Total 6 hours of Spa and some extra teams there in LMP2 taking in the race in preparation for Le Mans, and it'll be run behind closed doors like most of racing in Europe has been, but we'll definitely be seeing who's the car to beat. You know, Toyota has really been the dominant factor in LMP1, and we don't see the Ginettas at Spa, so they'll only be up against one Rebellion, which had plan to do two entries, but they're down to one for Spa. And then Baikalis will be returning, actually. So that's some good news there. That'll be their first start of the season, which started at Silverstone in 2019, I think. Yeah, it's been a long season because now they're extending it through the end of November in Bahrain, provisionally, at least right now, depending on COVID. So, I think it's just great to get WEC back in action because it's been way too long since their last race at COTA in February.
Yeah, it seems like another lifetime ago, honestly. Yeah. Even COTA does. And that's when we were kind of starting to first hear some of the trickles that maybe something might be coming with this pandemic. And really it was just a couple weeks later, I guess, that everything started to shut down. And then take it back to Silverstone. Man, that doesn't even seem like it should be the same season, but here we are. Anyway, is what it is. We're looking forward to the coverage for sure, and you can check out the website, sportscar365.com, throughout the weekend for all the latest from Spa. That's it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening. A rating and a review on iTunes would be very much appreciated, as would questions or comments for future shows. You can leave them in the comments section of this podcast or use the hashtag AskDoubleStint on Twitter. Talk to you next week with our next edition of the podcast. We'll be right back.